The next discussion focused on the AVAIL trial. As in Alan Sandler's 2005 report of ECOG 4599, the first phase 3 randomized trial looking at chemobevacizumab in metastatic disease, an advantage was also seen for progression-free survival with the addition of bevacizumab in the AVAIL study. In 4599, the chemo backbone was carbopaclitaxel, and in AVAIL, it was cisplatinum gemcitabine. In AVAIL, while Bev caused a significant increase in progression-free survival, no overall survival data were reported, in contrast to 4599, where a significant overall survival advantage was reported. Another interesting aspect to AVAIL was that there were two Bev randomization arms, one utilizing 15 milligrams and the other 7.5 milligrams every 3 weeks. Although the trial was not designed or powered to compare the two arms, both led to what appeared to be a similar improvement in progression-free survival. We polled the think tank faculty on a variety of issues, and in terms of current non-protocol dosing of Bev, all of the investigators are continuing to use the 15 milligram dose that was utilized in the ECOG 4599 trial evaluating bevacizumab, paclitaxel, and carboplatin. Dr. Lynch commented on what was perhaps the most controversial lung cancer question coming out of ASCO.
I personally am not convinced yet that there is a dose response to Avastin in cancer. There's not in colorectal cancer. I don't believe there is in lung cancer. I think it's an active area of investigation. And I think that the good news from AVAIL, the study was positive. Both doses are safe. And that's why I think it's perfectly fine to use 15. It's a safe dose. You can argue from the pharmacoeconomic standpoint, but that's not really what we're supposed to be doing. The only difference, I think, is the difference in hypertension.
Can you elaborate more about what you saw in terms of the AVAIL trial, Tom, in terms of the difference in toxicity, 7.5 and 15?
Both arms of the study were very well tolerated. It showed the drug could be given with a non-taxol-containing regimen with very good safety data. There was slight differences in the rate of hypertension. There was more hypertension for 15 milligrams compared to 7.5. But most importantly, the toxicity we're most worried about, which is hemoptysis and bleeding, was similar between the two arms. So it looked like safety-wise, people can feel comfortable in either dose of drug.
Corey, can you elaborate on your thoughts about the study?
Sure. I think maybe I'm being prejudiced in favor of North American trials, but there are a lot of flaws. I think we've all acknowledged this, but we really never really discussed the issues that come up with this. I think possibly one of the biggest flaws is the fact that they actually changed the endpoint in the midst of the study. It was originally powered for survival while it was accruing. Before it was analyzed, progression-free survival became the primary endpoint. A number of us have felt strongly that if that were the case, you should look at progression more frequently, that the scan intervals should have been shortened from every 3 cycles, which is, I believe, what was used, to perhaps every 2 cycles to increase the sensitivity of detecting progression. This was a placebo-controlled trial, so unlike ECOG 4599, where there was no placebo, and I think that potentially affects the trial in several different directions. One could argue it's a cleaner trial, but if you actually break the code and stop the placebo on the control arm, once the chemo's done, I think progression-free survival potentially falls out the window. And finally, and this I found most curious of all, a fairly high percentage of patients went on to second-line therapy in the absence of true progression. And they actually have shown separate analyses, the overall analysis, and then excluding those who went on to second-line treatment in the absence of progression. And the PFS actually looks better when you get rid of those patients. So I don't know how any of this plays, but I know that any one of these could potentially affect some of the data.
Nasser?
Well, just a couple of points. So I think also I agree with Corey, when you change the primary endpoint to progression-free survival, you do need to check more often. The placebo control actually enhances the validity of a progression-free survival endpoint. Although my understanding is that 2/3 of the patients were actually unblinded to the physicians because initially it was a survival endpoint. And so actually 2/3 of the patients were known what they were on to the physicians. So that you lose the blind in the progression-free survival. Having said that, and all the caveats about how the study's not powered to compare the dosages, if at the end of the day the survival's the same, you now have a study that has 900 patients, which is a much larger study than a small randomized phase 2 that ECOG originally did that set forth the 15 milligram dose. The randomized phase two was carbotaxol versus carbotaxol plus Bev at 7.5 versus Bev at 15. And it was only 30 patients per arm. So that's a very small study to determine the dose of a drug. Here you may have a 900-patient study in which the survival may not be any different. So I don't think that should be ignored. Now, is there something inherently different about bevacizumab when you combine it with cisgem versus carbotaxol? I seriously doubt it.
Joan, of course, one of the first questions that came up after this presentation is, what about the adjuvant study 1505? What are your thoughts about dose? And I guess the adjuvant trial at this point is using 15, correct?
And we'll continue to do that. Again, since all of the data that we have in terms of survival is with the 15 milligram dose, that's the dose that we will use going forward. The other point I was going to make about the VAIL trial, though, was that, in fact, there were really two placebo arms, one placebo arm for the 7.5 and the other placebo arm for the 15 milligrams. And apparently that was because bevacizumab, when it comes in 7.5 versus 15, comes in a different volume. So they had to come up with two different placebos.
Wow.
And it turns out that the 15 milligram placebo arm did very poorly. And those patients came off study earlier, presumably due to concerns from the physician about the 15 milligram dose. They were blinded to placebo versus bevacizumab, but not dose. So there were two placebo arms in actuality.
Alan, of course, we're interested in your perception of this because of 4599.
Everything that's been said around the table is correct, and that's the problem, is there really is no, I mean, I guess if you want to be strict, I mean, what Nasser said is with the randomized phase two, it's true that a dose was chosen based on very little data, but as a result, 4599 is the only study that showed a survival advantage, and the dose used was 15, so that's the one that has the best level of evidence. Technically, you know, we've all said this, at least one person around this table at one time in their career has said, well, I can't believe that is not a non-inferiority study based on those few number of patients, and so you can't utilize that study to refute the different doses or whatever. Having said that, in practical speak, sure, everybody, I think what we do here is going to be interesting. But in the community, I would assume a lot of folks are going to reach for the 7.5 for a lot of different reasons. And would it be the worst thing in the world? No, if there's no true survival differences, again, as Tom said, although, again, strictly speaking, what I will do is probably at this point utilize that 15. And I think that's sort of what we have to do given the data that's there. But you know, there's a lot of compelling evidence. The way I look at it is I think it's classic oncology oncospeak, where we begin to argue the number of angels on the head of a pin. I think the point of the study was you have supportive evidence that Avastin or bevacizumab does in fact have activity in non-small cell lung cancer when added with chemotherapy, in this case a cisplatin-based chemotherapy regimen. It was designed for time to progression. It met its endpoint. It was not designed specifically to look at the two different doses, although we will, and I think that's all that you can really take from it. It's unfortunate because that's what we're left with, and as I've said, I personally think that this study was terribly designed and looked like it was designed by one of their competitors, not actually by a partner, and it's unfortunate.
I'm just kind of curious, though, Alan, as you sort of look at it, addressing a question Tom commented on, toxicity of 15 versus 7.5. Roughly equivalent, a little bit more toxicity with 15?
I think that in general, I think what it showed is that the toxicity, again, was pretty similar to what was seen in our ECOG study, 4599. There were some differences, but you know, their entry criteria were a little bit different too, which I think you have to play into. But in general, the major toxicities, I mean, the incidence of bleeding was about the same or even maybe a tad bit lower. Hypertension was roughly the same, I think, maybe a little bit higher. Some of the not critical toxicities were a little bit higher in the dose, like I think maybe proteinuria and maybe hypertension, maybe a little bit more dose-related, but the severe toxicities were roughly similar.
Mark?
Yeah, I was reacting to a comment that Alan made, and that is that it was a poorly designed trial. I don't think it was a poorly designed trial. I think it was a poorly conducted and executed trial.
Point.
And it still baffles me that you would change the endpoint after 800 patients have been accrued. And we have to keep in mind that the interval for assessing progression-free survival was different than ECOG 4599. And the initial design was a survival question. I think Alan hit the nail on the head. All we can really take from this trial is that it's a second positive trial. and we've admitted all the flaws in this trial, it hasn't changed how I behave in terms of how I dose patients or who I select for treatment. It has changed the number of regimens that I would give bevacizumab with. You know, if you have a GEM regimen and a Taxol regimen, it covers about 100% of your lung cancer population. So I think that that was the real value of this trial, is reinforcing 4599 and giving us safety data with another doublet.
Tony, how do you think an educated patient might see this?
I think most patients would look at this, say educated patient, let's say medically educated, one of us could be a patient, and would pick the higher dose right now based on the data available. One of the things that sort of slides by during these discussions is that adding bevacizumab to chemotherapy makes it more toxic. When you look at Allen's study, paclitaxel and carboplatin is relatively well tolerated in terms of myelosuppression, thrombocytopenia. Now, clinically, this may not mean so much in skilled oncologists' hands, but the fact is adding Avastin to chemotherapy makes it more toxic. Even myelosuppression is substantially worse, and that's something that's overlooked a lot, I see, by oncologists.
Ed, do you agree with this, and what chemotherapy agent or agents do you tend to combine with bevacizumab right now in a non-protocol setting?
It's interesting, again, as we, I think Alan mentioned this sort of onc talk, onc preaching, we're sort of, again, arguing the dose of the third drug added to a doublet, and I still don't know if we know the question of the doublet. Again, I would argue that not everybody uses the doses or the regimens that are from ECOG 4599. Taxol dosage at 200, I would question if most physicians are even using that dose out there in combination. I think now we're introducing CisGem, and I think you could argue that most of the studies, the larger studies, have shown probably Cis to be a little bit better than some of the carbo regimens out there. Again, they're all relative, and they're not all 10,000 patient trials like we would have in breast, but it did take 10,000 patients to roughly determine whether an aromatase inhibitor was better than tamoxifen. And I don't think we need a study like that in lung cancer. I would not want to do that study, but I think right now we're sort of one degree further discussing a dose of a complementary drug to chemotherapy when really, I don't know if all the chemos are equal. We don't use carbotaxol in the adjuvant setting. We use cis-based regimens. And so, again, I think it's a really relative difference.
So bottom line, your practice, non-protocol setting, 15. Theoretically at 100 patients, what are they going to be getting? What's the spectrum, what you're going to use with Bev?
I think right now with my practice and the way I answered the question was is that I think any one of these regimens with carbo or cis is reasonable with 15. I think there's safety data enough out there. That's what I'll use.
So which chemotherapy agent or agents do you generally use?
The taxanes, either Taxol or docetaxel.
How do you decide between the two?
We try to enroll study first, but if not, I wrote the study with docetaxel, and so that's been my preference. But I think any of them are reasonable.
Vince, how are you approaching this question? I'll study both dose of Bev as well as choice of chemotherapeutic agent.
Well, I continue to use 15, but I think I've honed in even a bit more in platinum taxane doublet till the die's fully been cast on survival from the AVAIL study.
Okay. Harvey?
Just a different issue going forward. I mean, this drug, bevacizumab, may eventually be used up front. I mean, I just looking into the future as far as trials of induction. Now, will it make a difference as far as toxicities or time to surgery based on either 7.5 or 15? We know that we're concerned about operating too quickly on these patients. Is this something that needs to be looked into? Or do we think that this drug will be one that we'll use in induction? And if so, should surgeons or should we be concerned about whether we have to modify things in the future, do a trial that looks at that?
Vince, what do we know about that?
So we are doing a study at Memorial, an induction trial with locally advanced disease where patients get docetaxel, cisplatin, and bevacizumab for four cycles of chemo, but omitting bevacizumab in the fourth preoperative cycle so as to at least, in theory, and we're flying by the seat of our pants a little bit, but make things more safe at the time of surgery. So far, we've had 15 or 20 patients go to surgery, and we have not had any intrathoracic complications. We've certainly had some complications with the Bev, similar to those that you see in larger series.
And, of course, the same strategy is being done in breast cancer. They have the big NSABP B40 trial. They give chemo Bev, then they stop the Bev, keep the chemo going, and do the surgery. What's the actual interval Vince, in your study there between the last Bev dose and surgery?
I would say the median time is probably 7 to 8 weeks, because it's 3 weeks with the cycle, then it's another 3 to 4 weeks to get the scans and book the OR time.
And Harvey, that's kind of been the rule of thumb in the colon studies, rectal, et cetera. Is that what you're buying into?
Yes, and in patients that come to me for whatever reason as a second opinion, and they've had bevacizumab, we're waiting routinely 6 to 8 weeks.
Corey?
I assume you excluded squamous patients from that trial, or did you include them?
The way the trial is written is actually sort of cute. It's not my trial. I'm not advertising things. But we will give Bev to the non-squamous in the induction portion, but after surgery, it's written that individuals may have up to a year of adjuvant Bev for those who had a good result surgically and so forth, and those will include the squamous population with the tumor out, so to speak.
Tom?
How do you handle hemoptysis post-op, the fact that everyone spits up a little bit of blood post-op?
That doesn't happen at Memorial.
Oh, doesn't happen.
Only
okay.
Right.
I almost feel guilty about asking this, but I have to because I love anecdotes. Any patients you've seen who've had responses that kind of surprised you?
The thing we've been doing, and it may not be terribly exciting, but one thing we've done is we've given the first bevacizumab alone and then rescan folks 2 weeks later, because there's never been a formal study of Bev, you know, as monotherapy. And we do see occasional PRs, and certainly if you do the waterfall plot, you do see some shrinkages. Now, you don't know if that's the tumor cells. You don't know if that's interstitial pressure going down.
That's just Bev alone, one dose of Bev.
But you clearly see, if you put the waterfall plot up, it looks favorable.
Wally and I were talking about Chris Willett's work in rectal cancer, where they gave preoperative Bev, chemo, and radiation. But they did the same thing. They gave a dose of Bev just to see what happened. They saw some vascular changes. I'm not sure they saw. I think they might have seen some tumor response. So you actually saw partial responses?
I think there's one or two PRs, but there are a number of patients where tumor by 3D reconstruction's clearly gotten smaller.
Alan, what do we know about single-agent Bev and non-small cell?
Well, not a lot other than stories like that. But in the clinical trials for the randomized phase 2 study, there were 19 patients, I think, who received second-line Bev who had no responses but survival of over 12 months in the crossover portion of the randomized phase 2.
It was remarkably good. And remember, that predates the era of the waterfall plots. I'd love
right.
to see that re-looked at.
That's right.
Tony?
You know, the issue of which chemotherapy, quote, should be used, unquote, with bevacizumab is still out there. A purist would say that only paclitaxel carboplatin should be used based on the data we have. But it's interesting the way purists change their mind when it doesn't fit their bias. In my view, virtually any of the chemotherapies that are thought to be equivalent in advanced disease, advanced non-small cell lung cancer, that have phase 2 safety data, are reasonable to use with bevacizumab. The proof of principle has been laid out there. It's there. It improves the therapy. So to argue about which chemotherapy to use it with, as long as there's safety data, to me is not a relevant argument right now.
I'm so glad that Tony could make it this year because he's my designated anti-purist, and I'm going to depend on you all day long. I don't want you to take that personally.
I don't.
But I'm going to depend on you all day long to provide that perspective.
As discussed by the faculty, with two major randomized trials in the first-line metastatic setting demonstrating a benefit to adding bevacizumab to chemotherapy, first, trial 4599 with carboplatin, and now CISGEM and AVAIL, most investigators and practicing oncologists use Bev for metastatic disease with a variety of regimens. And in the faculty poll, while carboplatin Bev was used by all investigators, 9 other Bev combinations were identified utilizing docetaxel, nab-paclitaxel, gemcitabine, pemetrexate, and navalbine. However, a key issue in this clinical situation is the increased risk of hemoptysis with bevacizumab.
The mechanism that's purported, that you form cavitation and that if it's near a vessel that potentially could bleed, you bleed into a cavity, that's certainly possible. But I don't have any great explanation for the mechanism because there are plenty of people cavitate and don't bleed. And vice versa. And there are plenty of people who bleed who don't cavitate. So that I don't feel 100% comfortable that we have a great explanation for the mechanism of bleeding. And the other question is, how do we predict who's going to bleed? And I haven't been convinced that I've seen anything other than squamous cell histology that has led me to feel comfortable in terms of handling the question of hemoptysis.
Is it your take that this is associated with response?
The only problem is some people actually bleed quickly. So they bleed the first or second cycle. But I would say yes. If you ask my bias is it is associated with response.
And you see a patient who starts to have a very rapid response, but it's cavitary. What are you going to do?
Well, so that becomes a huge question. And I was sitting in Mark and Ruggiero's meeting in Florida, got emailed from someone who showed me a beautiful response of a tumor to carboplatin bevacizumab, had become completely cavitary, and said to me, Tom, what do I do now? And I was sitting there with Ruggiero, and I said, listen, I'd keep it going. That's exactly what you're aiming for. Ruggiero said, that's exactly what I would do. I would continue to treat with carbotax and bevacizumab. What the doctor did was consulted three other doctors, took the patient off study, and radiated the lung, and then put the person on maintenance bev afterwards. So the presence of the cavity led this doctor, who's a thoughtful oncologist, to give radiation. And I'm curious how other people would handle that big cavitary response.
What about radiation therapy as part of the mix here in dealing with these kinds of patients, Wally?
So we're talking about cavitation and radiation as it relates to giving bevacizumab or just as a management.
But to prevent bleeding.
To prevent bleeding.
Yeah, I mean, it's been used that way for decades, independent of bevacizumab, that hemoptysis is palliated or a hemoptysis-type situation with radiation independent of chemo, I mean, bevacizumab.
Would it make sense if the patient had just got chemo but had a cavitary response?
You know, the data is less clear on that, but intuitively it makes sense that it could work because there is a hemostatic effect of radiation that's been demonstrated. I mean, you see that in a bleeding cervix cancer patient. You see it in hemoptysis. You see it in hematemesis. I mean, it works after a small number of doses. There are even trials now in which a small dose of radiation is given prior to the use of bevacizumab in the trial for patients thought to be at high risk because of squamous histology, central disease, history of hemoptysis, or some other endobronchial disease. A reasonable approach.
Interesting. Yeah. Joan?
I was just going to mention 2 points. One regarding the cavitation, and that is on 4599, we did go back and retrospectively look to see if we could identify any factors that would predict for fatal bleeds, and the only one that stood out was cavitation.
So if they developed cavitation?
Both pre-
Actually, baseline was stronger than
development. Which is a marker for squamous histology,
right.
Probably.
But, and remember, the numbers are, fortunately, very small. We took the phase 2 study and added it to the ECOG study, working on the manuscript currently. But the overall numbers of significant pulmonary hemorrhage are relatively small.
So, Alan, what do you do to that patient who has the dramatic response and becomes cavitary?
It's funny because I got an email from one of your former fellows who's at Penn.
That's the same case.
Since okay. She sent it around the country. This is great. And I told her, I said, you know, this is one that I'd be nervous about, but this is, of course, what you'd like to see, that it's actually responding. I personally, I think I told her, I said, I might radiate and then go back and
So she listened to Alan and didn't listen to her former mentor. There you go. Okay.
That's what happens. You unleash them into the world, Tom.
Sure.
But having said,
thank you. You made my day.
But having said all that about the radiation, though, the preliminary studies in squamous cell that I think Wally mentioned, in which patients with squamous cell get radiated first, look like they are still having fatal bleeds.
Yes,
and in fact, one was just recently closed.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Mark, I mean that. Yeah. We have a trial at our place which uses Bev with chemo rads, and they get 2 cycles of induction. And we allow squamous cells on. And the one case of hemorrhage we've had has been a guy who had grade 3 hemorrhage when he was at about 36 gray. So despite getting radiation, and, you know, we go up to 74 gray. He was a squamous cell patient. He had 2 cycles of carbotax Bev induction. He cavitated. He didn't bleed.
He had a response, though.
He had a response, cavitary response, got started on radiation, and at 36 gray. Got admitted to the hospital with hemoptysis, had to be embolized, survived it.
This was a squam or non-squam?
Squam. Squam.
Wow.
Completed 74 gray. And so far, so good. He's about 6 to 7 weeks out from the end of his radiation.
Oh, part of the combined modality.
Yeah, part of the combined modality. So,
I'm sorry, with Bev?
With Bev. Yes. Well, we stopped the Bev after he hemorrhaged.
Can you update us on where we are with the TKIs, such as sunitinib? You've reported on that in terms of bleeds.
Certainly, I can tell you about the sunitinib trial. We had in the initial intermittent 4-2 schedule, 63 patients, 3 fatal bleeds, 2 pulmonary, 1 CNS. Serafinib had some bleeds.
Nasser, do we know about serafinib and bleeds? Can you comment on serafinib?
Yeah, so we had a HOG study looking at chemoradiation with serafinib, and I have in my personal experience, never had a patient die of fatal hemorrhage with chemo radiation for stage 3 disease. And I'm sure we've treated 150 patients over the last few years. And our third patient on the trial receiving a low dose of sorafenib died of fatal pulmonary hemorrhage. So I think the central location of the tumors is a big risk. And I do not give bevacizumab to the patients who have, you know, central cavitary lesions, squamous histology. I think at this point, even if we radiate these tumors ahead of time, we don't know that that's going to make a difference.
John? So you think it's the central location as contrasted to histology or cavitation? Is that what you just said?
I think that the patients who
are... Are you talking about metastatic disease or stage 3?
This is for stage 3 disease.
Oh, for stage 3.
For stage 3.
So in stage 4, you don't look at location?
You know, if it's hilar mediastinal lymphadenopathy, that doesn't worry me so much. But if the tumor is bulky and located right next to the pulmonary artery, that worries me.
Alan, obviously we don't have data on all these little specifics. So how do you look at this in your own patients?
Well, we went back and looked. Location never really has shown to be an issue. And what's interesting is, you know, is it the location to a vessel or location actually to a bronchus that might be more important to give it some opportunity to, you know, bleed and then come out and hemoptysize. But none of that actually has borne out. You're a little nervous when it's central, but we just forge ahead.
Just to comment, the AVAIL study did not find any relationship between location. Centrality yeah. did not seem to be an issue in that right. study as well. So I think centrality probably won't be a big right. concern.
Tony?
I think, yeah, overall, probably less than half the patients are eligible for bevacizumab as outlined in the study that was done, the major study. Less than half the patients. I mean, none of the performance status 2 patients were treated. No one on anticoagulation was treated. I know you can change that, but that's the way the study was written. No one with brain mets. No one with squamous cancers. I mean, you know, you're talking about a diminishing number of the total population of patients with non-small cell lung cancer if you're going to be strict and abide by the where the data came from. Again, this has importance for the average patient seen by the average oncologist.
I want to just touch on this issue of anticoagulation just to try to clarify it if we can. We asked you, anticoagulation can safely be administered to a patient with non-small cell receiving Bev. Most of you agree with that. A few of you are a little questioning about it. Alan, how would you answer that?
Yeah, so in the ATLAS study, we're doing it outside in just routine practice. I have not yet done that under the simple premise that, again, there are more lawyers than doctors in America.
Mark, anticoagulation and Bev.
No. I don't do it yet. If they're on anticoagulation at baseline and if they require it for some reason, I stop the Bev at this point.
The next topic discussed by the faculty was adjuvant chemotherapy for non-small cell lung cancer, and I deliberately picked Dr. Anthony Greco to discuss this subject because of his highly interesting remarks on the subject in an interview earlier this year for our Lung Cancer Update series, in which Dr. Greco, in stark contrast to most investigators interviewed for this series, flat out said that he uses carboplatin paclitaxel as his preferred adjuvant regimen. And actually, a recent Patterns of Care study indicates that oncologists in practice also prefer this regimen, in contrast to the CIS-based regimens that investigators prefer. Dr. Greco began the discussion by commenting on a recently published meta-analysis of carboplatin versus cisplatin in advanced disease.
The only thing I disagree about with this review is that they sort of stress, and it's, I guess, the bottom line that one should use cisplatin-based adjuvant therapy, and I'm not sure about that, but certainly that's the only studies that have been done. Cisplatinum and vinorelbine, back to Neil's point about being a purist, you should probably only use cisplatinum and vinorelbine. You should not change the vinorelbine if you're a purist. Well, for some reason, people say you shouldn't change the platinum, but they're willing to change the vinorelbine. Where's the data on that? I mean, you can turn this around 100 ways. And so the issue of platinum versus carboplatinum is never going to end, in my opinion, until we get off the platinums, which I hope happens because the drugs aren't that great anyway. But they're the best we have right now. And in advanced disease, in my opinion, the only advantage of cisplatinum over carboplatinum, this is based on my review of these meta-analyses, is that it appears that this response rate is higher with cisplatinum-based treatments.
I'm not sure it means a lot. Most of us say response rates don't mean that much. It's really the survival. Well, when you look at the survival, there is no difference in advanced disease between cisplatin-based therapies and carboplatin-based therapies. Now, if you want to do a subset analysis of a meta-analysis, which has even more flaws than doing subset analysis of a huge single study, you can make arguments that cisplatin has its survival advantage in advanced disease. Cisplatin in general is too toxic for many of the patients seen in the community centers. Not all, but many of the patients aren't in the trials that you see reported. You only see select patients reported in trials by NIH, by even our group. A lot of the patients that have lung cancer don't enter trials. And most of those patients, in my opinion, cannot tolerate cisplatin. Many of them can tolerate carboplatin. Now, when you make the argument that cisplatin is more toxic for elderly patients, if you make that argument, I'll make the argument that it's also more toxic for healthy patients. And I know there's a lot of controversy here, but unless I can see data to the contrary, I still believe there's no major difference in lung cancer between cisplatin and carboplatin. Ed?
I generally use cisplatin-based, and I'll tell people that if you go strictly by the data, cisvinorelbine is what you should use. I tell them I make one extrapolation with cis-docetaxel, and that's because of the non-inferiority-powered trial 326 in metastatic.
So 165-year-old people are going to get treated in your practice. Roughly, how's it going to break out?
I tend to use probably 60 to 70% of the time cis-docetaxel, and then another probably 30% of the time cisvinorelbine.
Nasser, choice of chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting. Oncologists in practice are curious about how you make these decisions. How do you go about, in a non-protocol setting, deciding which chemo regimen to use?
Well, I think all the options that others have talked about are all reasonable to do. I personally use docetaxel and cisplatin. The logic behind that is that docetaxel, in my view, is a slightly superior drug to vinorelbine in the metastatic setting. We have a number of head-to-head comparisons which suggest that. And vinorelbine is the drug for which we have the most data in the adjuvant setting. So I extrapolate that since docetaxel, in my view, is a slightly superior drug in the metastatic setting, it'll probably be a more effective drug in the adjuvant setting. And that's why I use it. But I have no qualms with others using cisplatin and vinorelbine or the other regimens used on the trials.
Any qualms about carbo, or are there any situations where you'd use carbo?
I don't see why you would use carbo. The patients who are not eligible for cisplatin, perhaps that's a group that you would use carbo. But cisplatin, the patients tolerate it okay. If the patients can't handle the fluid hydration with cisplatin, then they probably have comorbidities that would not have allowed them to go on the clinical trials in the first place.
Tom, and then Corey.
So I agree with what Nasser said. I answered the question that I give 90% cis-taxotere and 10% cis-gem. But then as I was listening to Tony's discussion, the reality hit. And the reality is I give 50% cis-taxotere and 50% carbo-taxol, okay? Because what we're not pointing out is the reality is when you see somebody who is 6 weeks post-op, who is, you know, 69 years old, and their creatinine is 1.7, and they don't look so great, we tend to use carbo. So I totally agree with you, Nasser. Intellectually, it should be cis and taxotere or cis-navarelbine or cis-gem. But I think we do use a lot of carbo.
It was so funny when I interviewed Tony, and I'd already interviewed, you know, 15 straight people who said cis. And Tony just goes, oh, you know, carbotaxol.
Yeah.
I'm pretty much in agreement with Tom, except I will use cisvinorelbine now. And I think for stage 2 and 3A specifically. So I'm a pseudo-purist, Tony, because for 1B, I'll still use paclitaxel carbo. The same rationale that has allowed us to include 1Bs that are 4 centimeters or larger in the adjuvant trial, again, based on retrospective data, I use for my choice of chemo in 1Bs. The best hazard ratio, when you break it down for each of these trials, looking at vinorelbine cis or IALT, which looked at various platinum-based combinations, the best hazard ratio in 1B was still on the CLGB trial.
Vince?
I think this is the one place where I do use vinorelbine. I mean, I think 50 of cisplatin is a whole different kettle of fish, and I find that better tolerated sometimes than Q3 week, cis or carboplatin with a taxane. So I putt along for 16 weeks, with cisplatin, vinorelbine, and other than infusion-related issues, we generally put a port in these people. People do real well with it. I tell them beforehand they're going to miss a couple of doses, but I think it's a very doable regimen.
Which cisplatin dose to use with the cisvinorelbine?
50, and then alternate the vinorelbine, yeah. 25, 12.5, 25, 12.5.
Does anybody use the real cisplatin vinorelbine regimen that was utilized in the positive adjuvant studies of 100 milligrams of cis? No.
This just goes to what Tony was saying earlier about how we kind of...
And this is the issue, is that people say they're a purist, and then right, they start using so the two out of 3 week. And remember, right. In BR10, those patients enrolled within 45 days after surgery. I mean, that was a very good right. subset
we
of people.
We participated when I was at Indiana. We participated in that study, and we had some sick patients with that cis-vinorelbine current regimen.